This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the Buick Enclave, the finest luxury crossover ever. Visit buick.gm.ca to see that where there's passion, there's beauty.
I'm Eleanor Wachtel, and this is the podcast edition of Writers & Company for the week of October 29th. Today, Anne Patchett, the award-winning author of the novel Bel Canto, takes on politics and the family in her new book, Run. Also, looking back at the unique voice of Grace Paley. 6 years ago, American novelist Anne Patchett published a novel about a hostage-taking in an unnamed Latin American country. Inspired by a real-life incident in Peru, where the captors and captives were together for many months, almost companionably, Patchett added what was for her an essential ingredient, an opera singer, a bel canto. The result was an unusual story about an odd mix of people, where everyone is somehow their best self, galvanized by the voice of the soprano. Bel Canto, the novel, was a great success. It won the Pen Faulkner Award and Britain's Orange Prize. It was also a great favorite of book clubs. Anne Patchett was born in Los Angeles in 1963, the younger of two daughters. Her father was a police officer, her mother a nurse. When Patchett was six, her parents split up and she moved with her mother and sister to Nashville, where she lives now. She went to Catholic parochial school, but by the time she was in high school, she was sending off poems to The New Yorker and 17 magazine. She went to Sarah Lawrence College, and before she graduated at 21, she'd already had a story published in the Paris Review. She went on to study at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and it was there she became friends with another writer, the poet Lucy Greeley, author of Autobiography of a Face. Greeley's treatments for childhood cancer had left her with the loss of part of her jaw, which led to many subsequent surgeries. Anne Patchett remained an extraordinarily close friend of Greeley's until her death a few years ago, attributed to an accidental heroin overdose. Patchett's memoir of that friendship is called Truth and Beauty. Now Anne Patchett returns to fiction with her new novel, Run. Set in Boston and Cambridge, Massachusetts, the story revolves around an Irish Catholic family, Bernadette and Doyle, their older boy, Sullivan, and their two adopted African-American sons, who are brothers. The boys' indirect encounter with their birth mother takes place on a snowy winter night and day, during which many big questions are raised about faith and family, politics and poverty, secrets and striving. I spoke to Anne Patchett while she was on tour in Los Angeles. Run is about the family that Bernadette and Doyle raise, including two adopted African-American sons. You said once that invented families or constructed families are your theme. Why do you think that is?
It's because I read The Magic Mountain in English class when I was 16, and I think ever since then I haven't been able to get away from that particular structure of a group of strangers are thrown together in a house. They're stuck. They can't go anywhere. And they have to build some sort of a society. I suppose also I could have been influenced by The Lord of the Flies, but in my book, the characters tend to really love each other and get along. So probably more Magic Mountain than Lord of the Flies.
Definitely. much more life-affirming, much more optimistic about the possibilities between people of connection.
I remember I got a review for Bel Canto that said it was Lord of the Butterflies. Oh, that's good. I like that.
That's very good. That's about this hostage-taking in unidentified South American country where people are literally physically trapped together for a long period of time.
And my first book, Patron Saint of Liars, was about a home for unwed mothers, which is, remarkably similar. They go to a really beautiful, huge house in the country, and they just sit there and wait.
Run is also about motherhood, but there aren't direct mother-child relationships, or they have to take place indirectly. Most of the children in Run have lost their mothers or are raised by someone else. Why this somewhat oblique approach, or what did you want to do with that question of motherhood?
This is a story about a father raising boys, And I think that it looks very much like a patriarchal line that goes throughout the book. It's about the fathers wanting the sons to carry on their traditions. It's about the sons deciding whether or not they can please their fathers and carry the burden of the father's expectations. And yet it is framed by a matriarchy. It is set in motion by a story of a statue that's passed from mother to daughter. And so at the same time, there is an undercurrent of motherhood running through it. There's a lot of connection or inspiration from Joe Kennedy and that story of a father having a son after son after son and trying to get him to be president, trying to get that son to pick up the job. And when one falls, he just keeps throwing out the next son. And I remember when I was doing a lot of research into the Kennedy family, one of the things I kept seeing again and again was people were saying that Ethel was really the great political mind among those children. And that one of Joe Kennedy's great lines is if one of the girls was sitting at the table and one of the boys would walk into the room, he would say, "Stand up and give your brother a chair," which is, you know, kind of a great line. And I think that there was a way in which I wanted to write that historically. I wanted to say, this is a story that looks like a patriarchy, but if you look very closely, it is about a matriarchy. And so I wanted the mothers to run along as an undercurrent beneath the story, and to say that no matter how well your life is going, and no matter how close your relationship with your father is, there's always going to be that longing for a mother, which is perhaps the difference between what we want intellectually, what our ambition is, and what our emotional needs are.
Ann Patchett, there's a strong political dimension to your novel, Run, most especially when the Doyle brothers quote from political speeches that they've memorized over the years. You say you're obsessed with political speeches yourself. What is it about them?
Well, I became obsessed with political speeches while I was writing this book. I mean, I knew that I wanted the character of Teddy to have a little obsessive compulsive disorder. And instead of counting his steps or tapping light switches, I decided that he would just be repeating political speeches all the time that he had memorized. This was a game that Doyle had come up with for the boys when they were little, and Teddy just never stopped playing it. He never stopped memorizing political speeches. So when I decided to have that attribute for my character, I started reading political speeches and really loving them. They're a fantastic art form. They're at their best, they're usually quite small and direct and motivating. I'm interested in the difference between what is written for speech as opposed to what is written to be read. And I really, really enjoyed doing that research. It was sort of like doing the opera research for Bel Canto. I felt like at the end of it, I came out with this new gift.
Right. With Bel Canto, you came out with especially a new appreciation for Renee Fleming. What are some of your favorites in terms of the political speeches?
I love that Eugene V. Debs speech that shows up twice in the book. "As long as there is a soul in prison, I am not free" is the only one that I'm remembering. And Jesse Jackson, I loved. And I actually went back and listened to a lot of his speeches on the internet, and they were incredible and so radical. America has really lost the left side of our party. I'm a great fan of Bill Clinton's, but I think that Bill Clinton picked up the left and moved it to the center, which ultimately made the right go so much farther to the right to get away from the left. But we really don't have a left now. We have a center and a far right. And Jackson really spoke for the left. And his ideas would be seen as really impossibly radical now. His speech about the patchwork coat, the quilt that embraces all of America, in which he talks about, you know, disabled Americans, you're welcome here, and gays and lesbians, you're welcome here, and the poor are welcome here. And I think there's no way in the world any politician is going to stand up and say that anymore. Also, I mean, of course, the speeches of Martin Luther King are amazing, and we all know I Have a Dream. But there are a lot of very radical King speeches, too, in which he talks about the redistribution of wealth in this country. And, you know, it's exciting to have that voice and to look back at those ideas and realize how much more progressive these men were at that time than we have now. I feel like there's nobody standing up and saying those things now.
I found the Eugene V. Debs speech, or at least part of it here, where you say, you're quoting, "I said then and I say now that while there is a lower class, I am in it. While there is a criminal element, I am of it. While there is a soul in prison," and so on. I guess one of the most surprising sources for these political speeches, along with Debs and Jesse Jackson and Martin Luther King and even Henry David Thoreau, is Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
I was just astonished. I mean, it's fairly benign, I would say.
Well, but the importance of that is that Teddy loves the speeches, not the politics. So Teddy is really interested in the beauty of the speech and the beauty of the form, much more so than he is making sure he meets his father's political standards. And say what you will about Ronald Reagan, Peggy Noonan was a great speechwriter.
Yeah, this one, I say it's astonishing, especially because, of course, the Doyles are Democrats and Doyle Sr. is a Democrat. So it's an inspiring quote. It's, "They had a hunger to explore the universe and discover its truths. They wished to serve, and they did. They served all of us." And then his father says, "Oh, Teddy, not Reagan, you know."
Shut up.
Yeah. When you were growing up, your father encouraged you and your sister to memorize poetry and recite it back to him under a spotlight in your hallway. Did you enjoy that?
No, not when I was five. I didn't enjoy it at all. But I can still recite if you'd like me to.
If you can keep your head when all about you are the Kipling.
Yeah, it's actually really handy on book tour. I find myself waiting at the luggage carousel in airports and if running through my mind. It's good in reviews. You read bad reviews. "If you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to set a trap for fools, and watch the things you've given your life to broken and stoop to build them up with worn-out tools." Really, just if you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve you long after they are gone, and hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to you, hold on. I mean, that's got book tour written all over it.
One of the characters says that politicians never talk about the details of life because it may not appeal to everyone, and she's annoyed that they speak in generalities and platitudes. What kinds of details is she thinking about here?
She's thinking about lead paint in hallways. She's thinking about the overcrowding of classrooms. She's thinking about health coverage for her child. She's thinking about working full time and not being able to walk her daughter to school and pick her up and having to leave her home alone at night while she's working. The details of hard life, of true hard life, that are never addressed by anyone.
Because
I think that most voters aren't particularly interested in those plights, and nobody wants to alienate everyone. You know, and I remember hearing Jesse Jackson when I was in graduate school, when I was in my early 20s in Iowa, and thinking I was so swept away by his messages that I found myself, and it says this in the book, the characters find themselves agreeing with things that they don't necessarily agree with, but you sort of get swept up in the passion of the moment. But I do think that people want to hear specifics. They want to have answers. They need details. And details are always going to be alienating.
You describe yourself as a Roosevelt Democrat. What does that mean for you?
An old-fashioned Democrat. A Democrat that is all for a good government helping the people. I think that the Roosevelt programs that were developed during the Depression and the Second World War that took people who didn't have jobs and put them to work for the country, that actually seems like a great idea to me, and now it's been turned into a total anathema. You know, there could be nothing worse than working for the government. There could be nothing worse than the government weakening its people by supporting its people, and that's not what I believe in.
The American writer and activist Grace Paley was sort of very politically out there, and she was one of your creative writing teachers. And I was interested to hear that you can't read Grace Paley before you write. Why not?
Oh, no. And I don't know anyone who can either. Her voice is so strong. And if I read Grace, I write Grace. And I think that's true for just about everyone I know who's a fiction writer. I mean, she just really obliterates your own voice, because her voice is such a powerhouse. And it's so completely her own. It just kind of takes you over. I mean it in the way of
in the best sense. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Anne Patchett, a life of service to community is a central theme in Run. Doyle, the father of the three boys, was mayor of Boston. He has high hopes that his sons will pursue careers in politics. Why is he so keen for them to go into politics?
These are privileged children that have had very, very good lives, and Doyle believes that there is a responsibility to your community and to your country. One of the central questions in this book for me is, you know, if you are smart and talented and a good person, is it enough to just do whatever you want to do? Do we have some responsibility to give back in our life? And, you know, it's one of the things that I've thought about a lot. You know, I'm smart and I'm talented and I'm writing novels. Should I be doing more with the gifts that I have in my life to help other people? And this is what Doyle and the boys are wrestling with. They're really, really good boys, but they've never had to make any sacrifices. They've always gotten to do exactly what they want to do. And what they want to do, you know, those are all good things, but they're not called on to make sacrifices. And I think in this day and age, in our country, where we're not called on to make any sacrifices, even though we're at war, it's something that I think about a lot. Shouldn't we have to do something for our country?
Because the two boys, I mean, Doyle says he wants to teach his sons about something that matters. And is he too narrow in his perception of a worthy cause, in the sense that scientific research doesn't measure up, because that's Tip's calling, and Teddy is interested in, has ambitions for the priesthood, that it's not enough?
I think that Doyle thinks it's not enough. And I think as far as scientific research is concerned, you know, he's not looking for the cure for cancer. Like I say, he's studying dead fish. And no, Doyle wants them to have higher expectations.
Is it significant that one son is dedicated to science, the other to religion?
It's significant insofar as there's a very vague parallel in the structure of this book with the Brothers Karamazov, which is really something that I put on just for my own amusement. But Sullivan, who's the oldest son, is the very passionate ne'er-do-well brother. The second one is the cooler, scientific, logical brother. The third one is the very, very sweet religious brother who is devoted to the elderly priest, Father Sullivan being Father Zossima. This is not anything I would think anyone in the world would read and think about, but it was a factor in how I made my decisions about the three boys.
You grew up a Roman Catholic. What part did religion play in your life?
Well, when my parents got divorced, my father was really the Catholic in the family, and he wanted my mother to keep me and my sister in Catholic school, so we got our Catholic education. And what that meant was we went to Mass in school, but we didn't go on Sundays, which was really fine. I mean, I was pretty much up to my earlobes in Catholicism. It's a great education for a fiction writer. I believed very much in worlds I couldn't see. I grew up with stories that were fantastical and believed them to be true. Butler's Lives of the Saints was the most important book I had when I was a kid. And I really did grow up believing that if you took your last crust of bread and crumbled it up for the little birds, that the little birds would come back with a piece of grain, every one of them, to fill up your sacks and take care of you. I love those stories. I every morning went up to the chapel when I was a little girl and said rosary with the rest of the school, and on my knees in front of great carved pieces of rock that we prayed to. Again, I just think that's a wonderful education for a fiction writer.
Do you have religious faith today?
Yes. I never really know what to say after that. Catholicism is not a proselytizing religion, and I self-identify as a Catholic. I do not go to church every Sunday. In fact, there are very few Sundays I do go to church, mainly because it really bores me. I find most organized religion is pitched to about a third grade level. And so I can go once or I could go twice, but week after week, it's just stultifying to me. I agree with virtually none of the politics of the Catholic Church. And yet, hey, it's my religion. It's what I grew up with. It's what my people, generations going back to Ireland, grew up with, and I claim it. Obviously, in a very lame way, but I do claim it.
No, I don't think so. I think that there is the best of what you're describing percolates through your books in terms of optimism and spirituality and faith in people and goodness and all those positive things.
I got so much from Catholicism, and I still do, which is that message of, you know, you are responsible for your neighbors. Look after other people. Whenever you have a chance to do the right thing, to do something good, do something good. If there is no God, so what? I'll never know the difference. I'll be dead, but I will have lived my life trying my best to do what's right. And I think that it makes other people's lives better, and it makes my own life better. And I think it is a fine message to pummel into the heads of children over and over again. You are responsible. You are your brother's keeper. You should love other people and hope they love you. Those are all good messages.
And I think you give them to your characters, too. I mean, in the way they live their lives. I read somewhere that you, as a kid, you feared being called by God to something that you might not have wanted, like becoming a nun or getting married.
Well, we were really raised with the idea of calling, you know, and I, as a child, took it really literally, like God would call you, the phone would ring, and you would get this message, and no matter what it was, you know, you had to go. It was like being called up to the armed services. And I was really terrified that I would get the call that I was going to be a nun, because the nuns were telling this all the time. Well, boy, I didn't think I was going to be a nun. And then one day I got my calling, and there it was. God said I was going to be a nun. And so I went, and God knew best, and it's been this wonderful, happy life. And I really wanted to be a writer. And it seemed that the only two phone calls that the girls in Catholic school were getting were the nun phone call and the get married phone call. And I wasn't really interested at that time in either of those phone calls. And there was never the phone call that you're going to have a really great career and be an artist and work really hard and do what is interesting to you.
Writing is clearly your calling. How did you become aware of it? How did you know that?
I was one of those kids, if you interviewed me on the radio when I was five and said, hey, Anne, what are you going to be when you grow up? I would have said, I want to be a writer. And I don't know what that's about. I don't know what that comes from, but I've always known what I wanted to do with my life, and I've never wavered from it. And that has been really the great gift in my life, because I think that the world is full of really talented, smart people who don't know what it is they should be doing. And I've always, always known what it is I wanted to do.
Anne Patchett, filial duty is one of your themes in this novel, Run. You've also written very movingly about your grand filial or granddaughterly duty. Tell me about Eva Mae Nelson.
Eva Mae Nelson Wilkinson was my grandmother, and she died 2 years ago last August at the age of 96. She was a great, great love in my life. In a way, I think it's pretty common where those loves sort of skip generations, although I love my parents very much. But my grandmother and I were real soulmates. And she had the most unbearable death. It just went on for years and years. She had years of dementia. She lost her eyesight. She broke her hip at the end. I mean, it was just one of those things where you keep thinking, oh, nothing else can go. And then something else went. She lived with my mother for 16 years. And then the last 3 or 4 years of her life, she was in assisted living. The last 2 years of her life, she was in an Alzheimer's unit. Although I think at that point, Alzheimer's, dementia, you know, it's really just a blur. And my mother and I took care of her, and you know, it was a hard job, and it was a great job because it was ours and because we loved her, and it was a wonderful thing to be able to love her for who she was at that moment in her life. I never expected her to be the person I had known growing up. I didn't miss the person who she used to be, but
You didn't miss?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I mean, because she changed every day. And it was really important for me to keep my love present with her where she was every day, to not expect her to be someone else, to not waste my energy missing what she couldn't do or be anymore, but to constantly see her and see her change and love her for who she was, you know, which at the end was just a little doll that I would go over and feed and brush and do her nails and I just kind of love on. It was really, really hard, but it was also really, really wonderful. I mean, it's always wonderful to love someone. It's never a wasted time.
And you dreamt about her after she died.
Oh, I dream about her constantly. I mean, I dream about her 2 or 3 times a week. I have a dream life that is probably much more interesting and full than my real life. She's still very much a constant in my life and in my consciousness, and it's a good thing.
Because I was reminded of, it seemed parallel to some of the dreams you had after your good friend Lucy Greeley died, and where she describes how she's fine and she's in a secret rehab, and some of your grandmother's dreams also, she's okay, you know.
Yeah, you find them again, and you're like, oh my gosh, I thought you were dead. I would have been looking after you. And they're like, no, you know, we're good. And I still have those dreams about Lucy, although they've changed. You know, I think as the years go by, Lucy gets better and better in my dreams. She gets stronger and happier, and she's terrific in my dreams, as is my grandmother. You know, my grandmother is not blind and unable to walk and completely helpless. She gets stronger over time, and we're always very happy to see one another. And I, of course, believe this is entirely a function of my own psychology and my own wish fulfillment. It's not that I want to say these are visitations. This is my brain comforting me while I sleep, and I appreciate it.
You see an inextricable connection between your grandmother and your husband, Carl.
Well, yes, in that I moved back to Nashville because I started dating Carl, and then I stayed in Nashville because I started taking care of my grandmother. And there were times when Carl and I went through lulls that if I had just been there for him, I probably would have said, okay, you know, we've been dating long enough and now I'm going to leave town and go on with my life. But because I was taking care of my grandmother, I really couldn't leave. And so because of that, Carl and I got through our lulls and would come back together again and be stronger and be happier. And the balance between staying for two people, it was almost like I don't know that I could have stayed home for either one of them, but for both of them I could, and it turned out to be a benefit for all three of us.
Why did you decide to get married after 11 years?
Because Carl was sick, and I was very aware that as his girlfriend, I wouldn't be able to do anything to help him if he was very sick. And for a short period of time, it looked like he was very sick. And we got married very abruptly. He had gone to the hospital, and there were some problems. And I said, "Okay, let's go home, and we'll get married." And we got a wedding, a marriage license, not a wedding license. What a thought! We got a marriage license, and have a friend who's a priest who runs a homeless shelter in Nashville, and we got him to sign the license, and we mailed it in, and I'd never told anybody. We never did anything about it. I had a morbid fear of weddings, and especially of wedding presents. And I realized that actually being married was fine. I just really didn't want to have a wedding. So anyway, we did that. I sold my house. I moved in with him. I prepared to take care of him and stand by him. And then he was absolutely fine like 6 weeks later.
Oh, that's a happy ending.
Yes, it was great because I really, really didn't want to get married. And I don't think I would have gotten married if that hadn't happened. But in fact, I was wrong. And getting married for us turned out to be much better. You know, Carl wanted to get married, and I always said, we have the best relationship of anyone I know. Why do we want to mess it up? And why do we have to do things the way everybody else does things? We didn't live together. It was perfect. But in fact, this is a much better setup that we have now. So I'm very grateful that things worked out the way they did.
Family ties and family history are clearly important to you in your personal life as well as in your fiction. And you've written about the close ties of friendship, in for instance, in Truth and Beauty. Is there a way that writing keeps those family connections alive for you or reinforces the connections for you?
No, I think that it is just a matter of what's at the center of my heart. And I think that if commitment to family and commitment to friends and commitment to society and community, you know, that this notion of a larger responsibility or both a large and a small responsibility to the other people in your life and in the world, that is what's closest to my heart. And again, that's what's going to come through in my work.
I'm so glad to have the chance to talk to you again. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Ann Patchett in Los Angeles. Run is published by HarperCollins. Last August, American short story writer and political activist Grace Paley died of breast cancer. She was 84. She published her first book of stories, The Little Disturbances of Man, almost 50 years ago. 15 years later came a second collection called Enormous Changes at the Last Minute. And then in 1985, Later the Same Day. Not much volume in three decades, but some of the most remarkable stories I've ever come across. Grace Paley was unique. It's not what she wrote about, women and their children, lovers, husbands, aging parents, and friends, so much as how she wrote. The stories are told in perfect pitch. Many of them are about a woman named Faith, a kind of alter ego for Grace. Grace Paley grew up in the Bronx. Her parents were Ukrainian-born Jews who emigrated to New York early in the last century. She retained something of her Bronx accent, although she lived most of her adult life in Greenwich Village, and later in Vermont. In 1995, Grace Paley was in Toronto for the International Festival of Authors. She read a story from Later the Same Day called Zagrowski Tells. Here's Grace Paley.
An old man is telling this story, and you'll get used to it, okay? I was standing in the park under that tree. This woman comes up to me, a woman minus a smile. I said to my grandson, "Oh, Emmanuel, here comes a lady. She was once a beautiful customer of mine in the pharmacy I showed you." Emmanuel says, "Grandpa, who?" "She looks okay now, but not so hot." "Well, what can you do? Time takes a terrible toll off the ladies." This is her idea of a hello. "Is, what are you doing with that black child?" Then she says, "Who is he? Why are you holding on to him like that?" She gives me a look like God in judgment. You could see it in famous paintings. Then she says, why are you yelling at that poor kid? What yelling? How are you, by the way, miss? I was embarrassed. I forgot her name absolutely. Well, who is he? You've got him pretty scared. Me? Don't be ridiculous. It's my grandson. Say hello, Emmanuel. Don't put on an act. She says, your grandson? Really is. Your grandson? What do you mean, your grandson? It's Sissy's kid. You know my Sissy. I see she knows something. Why not? I had a public business, no surprise. Of course I remember Sissy. She says this. Her face is a little more ironed out. So my Sissy, if you remember, she was a nervous girl. I'll bet she was. Is that a nice way to answer? Sissy was nervous. The nervousness, to be truthful, ran in Mrs. Z's family. Ran. Galloped. I remember your wife very well, this lady says. Very well. She puts on the same face like before. Her mouth gets very small. So what happens to Sissy? Emmanuel, go over there and play with those kids. No? No. When she was a kid, you should have seen her. She's a nice-looking girl now, even when she has an attack. But then she was something. The family used to go to the mountains in the summer. We went dancing, her and me. What a dancer. People were surprised. Sometimes we danced till 2 a.m. I don't think that was good, she says. I wouldn't dance with my son all night. All of a sudden, I put her in a certain place. Then I said to myself, Iz, why are you standing here with this woman? I looked her straight in the face and I said, Faith, right? Listen to me. Now you listen, because I got a question. Is it true, no matter what time you called, even if I was closing up, I came to your house with the penicillin or the tetracycline later? You lived on the fourth floor, walk up, your friend, what's her name, Susie, with the three girls. I see it very clear. Your face is all smeared up with crying. Your kid got 105, maybe more, burning. You didn't want to leave him in the crib screaming. You're standing in the hall. It's dark. You're living alone. Am I right? So young. Also, your husband comes to mind. Very jumpy fella. In and out. He drank, I betcha. Irish. Imagine, you didn't get along, so you got a divorce. Very simple. You kids knew how to live. But this is all used to be, and in that place there's not only good but bad. And the main fact in regard to this lady, I did her good. To me, she didn't always do so much good. Then I take a deep breath. Okay. You're still listening. Let me ask you. If I did you so much good, including I saved your baby's life, how come you did that? You know what I'm talking about. Perfectly nice day. I look out the window of the pharmacy. I see four customers that I see at least two of them in their bathrobes crying to me in the middle of the night. Help, help. They're out there with signs. Zagrowski is a racist. Years after Rosa Parks, he refuses to serve blacks. It's like an etching right here. I point out to her my heart. I know where it is. She's naturally very uncomfortable when I tell her. Listen, she says, we were right. I grab onto Emmanuel. You? But listen, she says, like this is not in front of my eyes, like the pest is only a piece of paper in the yard. You didn't finish with Sissy. Finish? You almost finished my business. And don't think Sissy didn't hold it up to me later when she was so sick. And I thought, why should I talk to this woman? I see myself how I was standing there that day. How many years ago? Like an idiot behind the counter waiting for customers. Everybody is peeking in past the picket line. It's the kind of neighborhood, if they see a picket line, half don't come in. The cops say they have a right. I was disgusted. I went to the street. After all, I knew them. I tried to explain. Faith, Ruthie, Mrs. Kratt, a stranger comes into the store. Naturally, you serve the old customers first. Anyone would do the same. Also, they sent in all kinds of people, all colors, to tell the truth. I didn't like the idea my pharmacy should get a reputation to be a cut-rate place. They move into a neighborhood. I did what everyone did, not to insult people too much, but to discourage them a little bit. They shouldn't feel so welcome. All right, a person looks at my Emmanuel and says, hey, he's not altogether from the white race. What's going on? I'll tell you what, life is going on. You have an opinion, I have an opinion. Life don't have no opinion. I moved away from this faith lady. I didn't like to be near her. I sat down on the bench. I'm no spring chicken. Cock-a-doodle-doo, I only holler once in a while. I'm tired. I'm mostly the one in charge of our Emmanuel. Mrs. Z stays home. Her legs swell up. It's a shame. In the subway once, she couldn't get off at the right stop. The door opens. She can't get up. She tried. She's a little overweight. She says to a big guy with a notebook, a big colored fella, please help me get up. He says to her, you kept me down 300 years. You can stop. You can stay down another 10 minutes. I asked her, Nettie, didn't you tell him we're raising up a little boy brown like a coffee bean? But he's right, says Nettie. We've done that. We kept them down. We? My two sisters, my father was being fried up for Hitler's supper in 44. You say we? I'm tired right now. This Faith could even see I'm a little shaky. What should she do? She's thinking. She decides the discussion ain't over. She sits down sideways. So what about Sissy? Is she all right? She's fine. She lives with me and Nettie. She's in charge of the plants. It's an all-day job. But why should I leave her off the hook? Faith, I got to say, oh boy, what you people put on me. You want to know how she is? You? Why? You? Sure. You remember you finished with the picket line? I don't know why. Tired? Summer, maybe. You got to go away, make trouble at the beach. But I'm stuck here. All of a sudden, I see Sissy outside. She has a sign also. She must have got the idea from you women. A big sandwich board. She walks up and down. Someone talks to her. She presses her mouth together. I don't remember that, Faith says. Of course, you were already on Long Island, Cape Cod, somewhere, the Jersey Shore. No, she says, I was not. I was not. I see there's a big insult to her. She should go away for the summer. So I said to this Faith, I tell you how Sissy is, but you got to hear the whole story, how we suffered, how we took our own Sissy from here to there to the biggest doctor. I had good contacts from the pharmacy. Dr. Francis O'Connell, the heavy Irishman over at the hospital, sat with me and Mrs. Z for 2 hours, a busy man. He explained it was one of the most great mysteries. They were ignoramuses. The most brilliant doctors were dummies. But still in my place, I heard this cure, that cure. So we got her massaged 50 times from head to toe, whatever someone suggested. We stopped her with vitamins, minerals, if she would take them. Sometimes she shut her mouth. To her mother, she said dirty words. We weren't used to it. Meanwhile, in front of my place every morning, she walks up and down. She could have got a minimum wage if she was so regular. Her afternoon job is to follow my wife from corner to corner to tell what she'd done wrong to her when she was a kid. One day her mother says to her, Sisala, comb your hair for God's sakes, darling. For this remark, she gives her mother a sock in the face. I come home, I see a woman, not at all young, with two black eyes, a bloody nose. The doctor says, before it's better with your girl, it got to be worse. That much he knew. He sent us to a beautiful place, a hospital, right at the city line. And that's how I found out that I was saving up my money for. I thought for retiring in Florida to walk around under the palm trees in the middle of the week. Wrong. It was for my beautiful Sissy. She should have a nice home with other crazy people. She looks at me, this Faith. She can't say a word. She sits there. I know what she wants to know. How did Emmanuel come in the story? When? When? I didn't mind telling. I explained that already. So it begins. One day my wife goes to the administration of Sissy's hospital and she says, what kind of place you're running here? I have just looked at my daughter. A blind person could see it. My daughter is pregnant. What goes on here? Pregnant, they say, like they never heard of it. And they run around and the regular doctor comes and says, yes, sure, you got more news, my wife says. And then meetings with the weekly psychiatrist, the day-by-day psychologist, the nerve doctor, the social worker, the supervising nurse, the nurse's aide. My wife says, but Sissy knows. She's not an idiot, only mixed up and depressed. She knows she has a child in her womb, inside of her, like a normal woman. She likes it, my wife said. Meanwhile, they investigate thoroughly. It turns out the man is a colored fella, one of the gardeners, but he left a couple months ago for the coast. The office apologized. Apologized? The supervisor was on vacation that week. The only hope that she could live a half-normal life, not in the institution, she must have this baby. She could carry it full term. No, I said, I cannot stand it. I refuse. You are laboring under a misapprehension, says the boss of the place. It's Sissy's connection to life. Also, it happens, she was crazy about this gardener, this son of a bitch, a black man with a green thumb. You see, I can crack a little joke, because look at this pleasure. I got a little best friend here. Where I go, he goes. Whenever I go down the Italian side of the park to play a little bocce with the old goats over there, they invite me if they see me in the supermarket. Hey, is Tony sick? You come on and play, okay? My wife says, take Emmanuel. He should see how men play games. I take him. And those old guys, they also seen plenty in their day. Also, a lot of those people are ignorant. They think the Jews are a little bit colored anyway, so they don't look at him too long. I didn't mean to get off the subject. What is the subject? How we took the baby. My wife, Mrs. Z, Nettie, she plain forced me. She said, we got to take this child on us. We will move out of here into the project with Sissy and be on welfare. You better make up your mind. I give in. Well, the bad part of the story is over. Now is the good part, naming the baby. What should we name him? Little brown baby, an intermediate color, a perfect stranger. Sissy is nursing. On her white flesh is this little black curly head. Sissy says right away, Emmanuel. Immediately. When I hear this, I say, ridiculous. No, she says, Emmanuel. Then she starts screaming, Emmanuel, Emmanuel. Okay, okay, everyone hollered, calm yourself. Okay, and bring the birth certificate, write it down. Let her see it, Emmanuel. In a few days, the rabbi came. He raised it up his eyebrows a couple times. Then he did his job, which is to make the circumcision. This is done so the child will be a man in Israel. That's the expression they use. He isn't the first colored child. They tell me long ago we were mostly dark. Also, now I think of it, I wouldn't mind going over there. They say there are plenty black Jews now. It's not unusual. They ought to put out more publicity on it, because I have to think where he should live. Maybe it won't be so good for him here, because my oldest son and his fancy ideas, forget it. What about your building, your neighborhood, I mean, where you live now? Are there other black people in the community? Oh yeah, but they're very snobbish. Don't ask me what they got to be so snobbish. Because, she says, he should have friends his own color. He shouldn't have the burden of being the only one in school. Listen, it's New York. It's not Oshkosh, Wisconsin. But she gets going. You can't stop her. After all, she said, he should eventually know his own people. It's their life he'll have to share. I know it's a problem to you, Iz. I know, but that's the way it is. A friend of mine with the same situation moved into a more integrated neighborhood. Is that a fact, I say? Where's that? Oh, there are. I start to tell her, wait a minute, we lived 35 years in this apartment, but I can't talk. I sit quietly for a while, I think, I say, be like a Hindu is, calm like a cucumber, but it's too much. Listen, Miss Faith, Miss, do me a favor, don't teach me. I'm not teaching you, is it? Don't answer me every time I say something. Talking, it's true, what for, to whom? Nettie's right, it's our business. She's telling me, Emmanuel's life. You don't know nothing about it, I yell at her. Go make a picket line, don't teach me. She gets up and looks at me kind of scared. Take it easy, he is. Emmanuel is coming, he hears me. He's got his little worried face. She sticks out a hand to pat him. His grandpa's hollering so loud. But I can't put up with it. Hands off, I yell, it ain't your kid, don't lay a hand on him. And I grab his shoulder and push him through the park, past the playground and the big famous arch. She runs after me a minute, then she sees a couple friends. Now she has what to talk about. 3-4 women, they make a little bunch, they talk, they turn around, they look, one waves. Hi, Iz. I tried to be quiet for the boy. You want ice cream? Emmanuel, here's a dollar, sonny. Go buy yourself a good humor. The man's over there. Don't forget to ask for change. I bend down to give him a kiss. I don't like he heard me yell at a woman, and my hand is shaking. He runs a few steps. He looks back to make sure I don't move an inch. I got my eye on him, too. He waves a chocolate popsicle. It's a little darker than him. Out of that crazy mob, a young fellow comes up to me. He has a baby strapped on his back. That's the style now. He asks like it's an ordinary friendly question, points to Emmanuel. Gosh, what a cute kid. Whose is he? I don't answer. He says it again. Really, some cute kid. I look at his face. What does he want? I should tell him the story of my life? I don't need to tell. I already told and told. So I said very loud, no one else should bother me. How come it's your business, mister? Who do you think he is? By the way, whose kid you got on your back? It don't look like you. He says, hey there, buddy, be cool. Be cool, I didn't mean a thing. You met anyone lately who meant something when he opened his mouth? While I'm hollering at him, he starts to back away. The women are gabbing in a little clutch by the statue. It's a considerable distance. Lucky they got radar. They turn around, sharp like birds, and fly over to the man. They talk very soft. Why are you bothering this old man? He got enough trouble. Why don't you leave him alone? The fellow says, I wasn't bothering him. I just asked him something. Well, he thinks you're bothering him, Faith says. Then her friend, a woman, maybe 40, very angry, starts to holler. How come you don't take care of your own kid? She's crying. Are you deaf? Naturally, the third woman makes a remark, doesn't want to be left out. She taps him on his jacket. I seen you around here before, Buster. You better watch out. He walks away from them backwards. They start in shaking hands. Then this Faith comes back to me with a big smile. She says, honestly, some people are a pain, aren't they, Iz? We sure let them have it, didn't we? And she gives me one of her kisses. Say hello to Sissy for us, okay? She puts her arms around her pals. They say a few words back and forth like cranking up a motor. Then they bust out laughing. They wave goodbye to Emmanuel, laughing, laughing. So long, years, see ya. So I say, what is going on, Emmanuel? Could you explain to me what just happened? Did you notice anywhere a joke? This is the first time he doesn't answer me. He's writing his name on the sidewalk. Emmanuel, Emmanuel, in big capital letters. And the women walk away from us, talking, talking. Thank you.
Grace Paley at the International Festival of Authors at Harborfront in 1995. Zagrowski Tells is from later the same day, and it's also part of The Collected Stories. Grace Paley died in August. She was 84. Writers and Company is produced by Mary Stinson. Nancy McElveen is associate producer. Technical operations by Rob Selmanovic. We put out a new podcast every Monday, and you can download the latest at cbc.ca/podcasting. We'd love to hear what you think of our podcasts, so just drop us a line anytime at podcasting@cbc.ca. We archive our podcasts online for 4 weeks, so subscribing is the best way to make sure you never miss another edition of Writers and Company. You can sign up at cbc.ca/podcasting. I'm Eleanor Wachtel. Next week from Pakistan and London, Mohsin Hamid, the author of The Reluctant Fundamentalist, brings a whole new perspective on his homeland. That's next week. I hope you'll join me.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.